listener production.
Hi, I'm Sasha Barbagat. Welcome to The Briefing. The vocation of sex work is nothing new. Super quick history lesson. The earliest recording of it found dates back to 2400 BCE in ancient Babylonia. And in Australia, women on the First Fleet were prostitutes. The essence of the work has stayed the same, but our attitudes have evolved, even from just a few years ago.
I think what we've seen in recent years, with the internet in particular, is that you've had a lot more women being prepared to engage in some kind of commercial sex who wouldn't have done it before, because it doesn't always necessarily involve person-to-person contact.
Today is part one of our four-part series looking at sex work in Australia in 2024, and we'll be getting a sense of how we ended up here. First, here are today's headlines with Bensyon Siebert. It's Monday, April 8.
Good morning, Sasha. A review into Australia's supermarkets will hand down an interim report today recommending massive fines for breaches under a mandatory code of conduct. The government asked economist and former Labor Minister Craig Emerson to examine whether current guidelines for Coles and Woolworths are enough to keep them honest amid allegations of price gouging customers and shortchanging suppliers. He'll recommend a mandatory code of conduct for the grocery giants, which could include some of the largest fines in Australian corporate history for major breaches. Fines for major breaches could be around $4 billion, or 10% of revenue for Coles and Woolies. Fines for minor breaches would be closer to the $200,000 mark, which would be a bit of a slap on the wrist, basically.
Mm-hmm. The current rules were written by the supermarkets themselves, and this was back in 2015 in response to public anger at their treatment of suppliers. Feels like history repeating a little bit. And importantly, the code isn't enforced. Emerson advised against divestiture powers in his interim report, it's worth noting. That would force companies to sell off parts of their business if they have too much market share. So, Bensyon, he's warning against that, saying that probably isn't the path to go down. But what he wants is basically for the current guidelines for the supermarkets to be given teeth. That is, they'd be enforced and these fines would be handed out for non-compliance, which, as you've mentioned, would be massive if they were 10% of annual revenue. Look, the current guidelines say supermarkets should not be, quote, reckless or unreasonable in their dealings with suppliers. And the thing for, you know, the farmers and the producers who are giving their stuff to Coles and Woolies, as well as Aldi and Metcash, is that they have reported not speaking up about things going wrong out of fear of retribution. Mm. And what this report says retribution can look like for these suppliers, it can be the unfavourable renegotiation of terms and conditions of supply, relocation of shelf space to less popular locations within stores, which just sounds so petty, and total delisting of a supplier's products. So Emerson wants rules included in a new code of conduct that would protect suppliers from retribution if they make a complaint.
Israel has withdrawn most of its troops from southern Gaza. The IDF confirmed the move, leaving all but one brigade behind in the area, believed to be made up of a few thousand soldiers. The spokesperson says it's another stage in the war effort, while Israel's defense minister says they're leaving to prepare for other missions, adding that we are reaching a situation where Hamas does not control the Gaza Strip.
One of those missions includes the long-threatened assault on the southernmost city of Rafah, where most of Gaza's civilian population is sheltering. And the White House has also weighed in, saying this move is likely so that Israeli troops can rest after months of fighting. And of course, as of Sunday, it's been 6 months since the October 7 attacks on Israel, in which Hamas militants killed about 1,200 Israelis and took around 250 hostages. 133 Israelis are still being held hostage, and 33,000 Palestinians have been killed since Israel launched its attack on Gaza in response to the October 7 massacres.
Yeah, and over the weekend, ceasefire talks picked back up in Cairo. We know quite a lot about the terms of a potential ceasefire agreement. They include a temporary ceasefire, the release of hostages, and the release of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. But the New York Times is reporting that some of the sticking points include the ratio of prisoners to hostages, the sequence of the releases, and the return of Palestinian civilians to northern Gaza. Now, one thing to keep an eye out for this week is Iran. Israel launched a strike on an Iranian embassy in Syria last week, which killed senior commanders of Iran's elite Quds force. Iran supports Hamas. It also backs the Houthis and Hezbollah in Lebanon. So if Iran decided to retaliate in a really strong way, that carries the risk of a wider war in the Middle East.
An asylum seeker who got separated from a group that arrived in WA by boat has been found. The unknown vessel came ashore in remote northern WA on Friday. The man was missing for 2 days before he was found. Luckily, he is in a relatively good condition, according to WA police. Now, this incident has sparked criticism of the PM, the coalition labelling it a failure by the government. Anthony Albanese has defended his government's record on border security, saying nothing has changed since Operation Sovereign Borders came in 2013.
Well, people smugglers will always try to change their methods in order to ply what is a dangerous trade. But there is no change to Operation Sovereign Borders.
That was the PM speaking there. WA's Premier Roger Cook has also weighed in. He says despite 3 arrivals in his state in the last 5 months, he is confident the current laws are working and he has faith in the government.
And the first pill testing pilot in New South Wales is starting today at the King's Cross Injecting Centre. The trial will run for 1 day a week over the next 4 months. 100 participants will be able to have drugs checked and be provided with an analysis, including details of the mix of drugs present and the purity of the substance. They'll also be given targeted harm reduction advice. It comes ahead of the New South Wales Government's Drug Summit later this year. The ACT is the only jurisdiction with a fixed drug testing facility, but Queensland has announced a fixed site in Brisbane to launch later this month.
We also saw a successful trial at the festival Rabbits Eat Lettuce last weekend, which was able to test a bunch of drugs for revelers, found substances in them that, you know, some people would have decided not to have taken. It's worth noting this drug summit is kind of sitting there as a post for the New South Wales government to potentially make further announcements around pill testing. They have been very reluctant to. The health minister in the past has historically said pill testing is not part of the government's reform agenda and maintains programs at music festivals are not a silver bullet against deaths. Perhaps this trial could give them some numbers to actually work with and maybe look to bring it in. Bensian, thanks for being here for the headlines. Next up, we are kicking off part one of our 4-part series looking at sex work in Australia in 2024. Welcome to part one of our 4-part series looking at sex work in Australia in 2024. Today we want to take you on a little journey through how the profession has evolved since colonisation, from law enforcement to safety to societal expectations. Think of it as the base from which we can explore the current state of play. I'm joined now by Emeritus Professor of History at ANU, Raylene Francis, who is also the author of the book Selling Sex. Raylene, thanks for your time. Look, the vocation of sex work is nothing new. Tell us about the beginning of recorded sex work in Australia.
Sex work in Australia is as old as the European settlement of Australia. So the first boatloads of convicts that arrived in Sydney in 1788 had women convicts on board, and a number of them were already practicing as sex workers in Britain before they were transported, and continued to do so in Australia, both when they were convicts and sometimes when they had served their term, they would continue to work in selling sex. other women who came out who hadn't had any previous experience of prostitution found that in the colony there were enormous incentives for them to also sell sex, and there were a lot of pressures to do so as well, because women were outnumbered by at least 4-1, often a 6-1, by the male convicts and the free settlers and the jailers and so on. So there was also actually an expectation by the British authorities that this would happen, that they thought it was much better that the men were engaging in sex with convict women than in sex with each other was the other main option they were concerned about, which they thought was far less desirable. I think what we've seen in recent years with the internet in particular is that you've had a lot more women being prepared to engage in some kind of commercial sex who wouldn't have done it before, because it doesn't always necessarily involve person-to-person contact, that you can have virtual sex and not actually be involved in having to deal with interpersonal relationships on a physical basis and the hazards that come with that and the challenges that come with that, and perhaps also the notoriety that comes with that.
You mentioned in your previous answer about how, you know, the authorities, when the convicts were coming over from England, kind of prepared for the inevitability that sex work was going to be happening in Australia. How has law enforcement attitude evolved to the industry over the years up until today?
So initially, the law in Australia was based on British laws, so laws around disorderly houses and so on, and those laws and the common law in Britain, and vagrancy laws especially affected women who found themselves arrested for soliciting in public places, so-called creating a nuisance in a public places, being a person of no lawful visible means of support. All of those things were inherited from the British legal system and transferred to the colonies, and then over time, as the colonies developed their own legal systems, adapted to different colonial situations. And what that's meant for us in Australia is that we still have different laws in each state, which are the states that evolved out of the original colonies. The main approach that was taken in Australia up until the 1970s was that sex work itself, selling sex, was not itself criminalised, but it was virtually impossible to sell sex without breaking the law in some way. Either you were breaking the vagrancy laws or the brothel keeping laws or the living off earnings, immoral earnings as they were called, trafficking, sex trafficking. But the way in which those laws were interpreted varied enormously from state to state. So in Western Australia, you had pretty much the same laws as in the other states, but over time, the police started to regulate prostitution in an unofficial but widely recognised way. So women were more or less forced to go into certain so-called red light districts, and they had to obey by a whole lot of rules which were clearly understood and dictated by the police and enforced by the madams. And that was all within the same legal system as you had in New South Wales, pretty much. And in other states, the police approached it differently. You had different levels of organised crime. So just to give you, you know, a rough overview, if you're in New South Wales, the Northern Territory, or Victoria, prostitution is now decriminalised and it's treated as any other kind of work. You know, you're subject to health and safety regulations and so on. And you might have to register your business as you would in another occupation. In Queensland, Tasmania, and the ACT, prostitution is legal, but it's regulated and operates still within the criminal law, so that if you break the regulations, then you can still be subject to criminal prostitution. South Australia and Western Australia, prostitution's legal, but it's not regulated. But effectively working in brothels and anything associated with living off immoral earnings are also illegal. So it's a crazy kind of system for a country. I mean, it's constantly evolving. Like the laws in Victoria were changed just in the last couple of years. So I mean, they used to have a licensing system as well. And they've moved under the influence, I think, of really important people like Fiona Patten, who's had a long-term engagement in advocacy for sex workers, to a more decriminalised system.
Mm. I mean, I'm a younger person, I'm a millennial, and I don't see anything wrong with it personally. However, I'm obviously just one person. What has the public opinion been on sex work in Australia, and where are we at now? Is it still taboo in certain circles?
Look, I think the stigma that attaches to sex work is still very real in Australia. It was always present, but again, it varied. Different communities felt differently about it. I think in the early 20th century, you had a lot more focus on respectability in those communities and a lot less tolerance of women who deviated from, you know, the expected roles that women would play in the family. That changed again in the 1970s, I think, with the more generally, you know, so-called sexual revolution. There was a freeing up of attitudes, but I think there's still, despite that, there's still, you know, a stigma. There's very few people who I think work in the sex industry who feel comfortable in all company in Australia announcing the fact that that's what they do for a living. And that reflects the recognition that people still look down on women who sell sex and men who sell sex for that matter.
Yes, of course. It goes both ways.
Always.
Look, I wanted to ask you about the dangers that still persist. I've just talked about how attitudes have changed, but as you've said, there are still lots of people who would look down on sex workers. What are the dangers that are still out there for women in particular who are engaging in sex work? And what are we doing, or where are we falling short in protecting them?
Sex work has always been a dangerous occupation for women. I mean, there have been a lot of dangerous occupations for women, but sex work's been particularly hazardous because of the exposure to violence from clients and also the exposure to sexually transmitted diseases. I think the violence these days is probably still a very real factor. And, you know, in some cases it's women are forced to work alone, or they're not able to work in small groups where they can protect each other, then there's still that real chance that they experience violence from violent clients. And not all clients are violent, of course, but, you know, you only takes one who is that way inclined. And there's still, I suspect, in certain areas of the police, a feeling that, you know, if you do that, then that's the risk you take and you have to wear it. And not so much enthusiasm to protect sex workers as they would, say, other workers faced with violence in the workplace.
Which is disappointing, given how different the laws are around sex work in Australia and the changing attitudes. You'd think that if anyone was going to be violent to anyone, it doesn't matter what they're doing for a job, violence is violence.
And the other thing that I should say too is that some of the worst violence that's been perpetrated against sex workers in the past, in particular, has been by police.
Mm, yeah. I did want to ask you before we let you go, the internet has come in and changed so much about our lives, and you kind of touched on it in a previous question, but I wanted to ask you specifically about the internet and how that has revolutionised sex work, especially in Australia.
I think the most important thing that the internet's done to sex work is made it so much easier for people selling sex to connect with potential clients. That has always been the big challenge, and that's why soliciting has always been so problematic. You know, if you have to go down the street and ask men if they're interested in your services, then you're immediately out there. You're breaking the law in most states of Australia throughout most of its history, and it's very difficult. There were laws against advertising in the mainstream press. The internet has actually freed up that communication. You know, there are certain channels and social media groups that you can access to advertise your services. And it has also meant that it's got a community of workers who can support each other. I mean, For a long time, there have been community of workers, and, you know, Scarlet Alliance is most well known probably in that area. But the internet makes it possible for people to connect across space much more easily and to share experiences and tips and so on, that I think has been very important. It's also meant that, as we were discussing earlier, that people who weren't necessarily inclined to, you know, join the formally organised sex industry are prepared and have been able to engage in a form of selling of sexual services online who otherwise wouldn't have done that.
That was Raylene Francis, Emeritus Professor of History at ANU. And that is all for this morning's EP. Thanks so much for listening. Part two of our Sex Work in 2024 series will be out this afternoon at 3 when we chat with a former sex worker and now brothel owner about how the internet has changed the industry. If you would like to see more from The Briefing, check us out on Instagram at The Briefing Podcast and on YouTube and TikTok. Search Listener Newsroom. That's LISTNR. I'm Sasha Barbagat. We'll catch you this arvo.
Listener.